Amendment, Democratic-led efforts to impeach U.S. President Donald Trump for a second time were the talk of Washington over the weekend, although it looked far from certain whether enough Republicans would back the move with just days left in his term as president. President-elect Joe Biden takes the oath of office on January 20th, officially becoming the President of the United States. Democratic members of the House of Representatives will introduce articles of impeachment, though, on Monday. The move comes after Trump stirred up his supporters on Wednesday, and they later stormed the U.S. Capitol. Several people died in the melee. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence will attend President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration, a senior administration official said this weekend. On Friday, President Donald Trump said he would not attend the inauguration of his successor on the 20th. And Georgia's newly elected Democratic senator, the Reverend Raphael Warnock, took to the pulpit on Sunday at Atlanta's famed Ebenezer Baptist Church, just as he has for the past 15 years. But this time he speaks as an incoming U.S. Congress member and the first Black U.S. senator from Georgia. This is the church where civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. once preached. Indonesian authorities Sunday located the black boxes of the jet that crashed into the sea soon after taking off from the capital, Jakarta, as body parts and pieces of the plane were retrieved. The Boeing 737-500 with 62 passengers and crew was headed on a domestic flight to Borneo on Saturday before it disappeared from radar screens 4 minutes after taking off. And Pope Francis urged Americans on Sunday to shun violence and seek reconciliation. This is VOA News. A Hong Kong website that publishes material mainly related to anti-government protests in 2019 said its users' access had been blocked by the city's internet service providers, or ISPs. The website, HK Chronicle, said it began receiving reports from Hong Kong-based users saying they were no longer able to access the site as of late Wednesday. Editor Naomi Chan said in a statement, quote, "After discussing and investigating with our supporters, we found that some ISPs of Hong Kong have deliberately dropped any connection to our servers so that the user could not receive replies from our servers, resulting in an inability to access our content." South China Morning Post, citing unnamed sources, said on Sunday that Hong Kong police had invoked the city's national security law for the first time to block Hong Kong HK Chronicles. The Hong Kong and Beijing governments say it is vital to plug holes in national security defenses exposed by months of sometimes violent anti-government and anti-China protests that rocked the global financial hub in 2019. Hong Kong police arrested 53 people in dawn raids on democracy activists on Wednesday in the biggest crackdown since China imposed the security law last year. Apple and Amazon have both suspended the social media network Parler from their respective app store and web hosting service, saying the social networking service, popular with many far-right wing users in the U.S., has not taken adequate measures to prevent the spread of posts inciting violence. The action by Apple and Amazon follows a similar move by Google on Friday. Parler is favored by many supporters of U.S. President Donald Trump, who was permanently suspended from Twitter on Friday. It is seen as a haven for people who have been expelled from Twitter. In a post on Parler, its chief executive said, quote, "This was a coordinated attack by the tech giants to kill competition in the marketplace." He added that the platform has many options for moving forward. Parler started in 2018 and was initially home for the extreme right, but now it attracts more traditional conservative voices, including Republican lawmakers. And global leaders will try to reignite international environmental diplomacy on Monday with a biodiversity summit that launches a critical year for efforts to stem the devastating effects of global warming and species loss. The event is called the One Planet Summit, and it will be virtual. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro Reporter for the Associated Press, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues from yet another historic week here in America's capital city, the first full week of a new year. Thousands of protesters who came here from around the country pledging loyalty to Donald Trump, saying they would fight to let him continue as president of the United States, invaded the United States Congress, breaking into the Capitol building with its landmark white dome overhead. In scuffles with police, one of the trespassers, a woman from California, was shot dead. Three other people died in medical emergencies. President Trump, in a video message, said he loves the protesters, but told them to go home. And the next morning, on Thursday, the White House put out a statement that there will be, quote, an orderly transition to a new president, meaning Joe Biden, on January 20th. We'll also analyze the election results in Georgia, a big win for Biden's party, the Democrats, winning control of the United States Senate. And the continuing tragedy of the coronavirus, actually worse than ever. Josh Glancy, you're a British reporter covering America. The last time the Capitol building was invaded was by British troops in the War of 1812. More than 200 years later, we all saw an insurrection, this time by American citizens trying to stop Congress from confirming Joe Biden's victory. Josh, what did you see?
Well, it was in many ways unprecedented and unbelievable scenes that we saw in the Capitol on Wednesday. I think on one level, it has to be viewed as an enormous failure of security. We all knew that this protest was going to happen. Anyone who follows the movement around Trump or the president himself saw the warning signs. They were very public about them. And yet when this group of very agitated protesters arrived at the Capitol building, the defenses were hugely insufficient. There were the Capitol Hill cops, and they were not there in great numbers, and they didn't seem to have any backup. And so on one level, we can see this as an enormous failure of policing and of national security. I mean, the fact is they had to, you know, evacuate the vice president at one point. He's number two in line to the presidency. You know, I mean, it's inexcusable on that level. On another level, obviously, there's a huge amount of recrimination has to go to the president for supporting and inciting this group of people to go and not just protest outside Congress, but invade the inner sanctums. I mean, you saw a guy with his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's office. You saw people waving the broken up plaque of the sign outside that says it's her office. They'd smashed it up and they were waving it in the halls of Congress. You saw a woman shot and killed. And we don't know the exact details of how this happened. An Air Force veteran who was protesting and was shot in the halls of Congress. These are astonishing scenes. I mean, as someone pointed out recently, America spends nigh on $1 trillion a year on defense and yet wasn't able to protect the halls of Congress. You know, that's an astonishing moment in the history of this republic.
It does seem that there will be hearings on just that very issue, the security of Congress. And you're right, more than $500 million in the annual budget of the United States Capitol Police. But what about the passions? I mean, what do we say about tens of thousands of people who really believe that there was cheating in the November election, that Donald Trump is being forced out of office wrongly? Ashraf Khalil, right, you cover this city for the Associated Press. You've reported on tumultuous events, including anti-Trump protests, changing of a city street near the White House. It's now called Black Lives Matter Plaza. This time it was like the pro-Trump side. Tens of thousands of his strongest supporters came to this city. They got a speech by the president. They marched to the Capitol. In everything you've seen, did you suppose that there would be a violent invasion of the Capitol building?
Well, having seen the last two prior pro-Trump protests, there was one in November, there was one in December, you could see an escalation in numbers and in violent tactics. The first one in November, I think, drew around 15,000 people. The one in December drew fewer. attendees, but a much larger contingent of people wearing Proud Boy colors, this sort of almost militia group that's taking the forefront in this movement. And they were very violent and they were looking for a fight. So I was expecting an escalation on those terms. The surprise was, as Josh said, the total failure to protect the building. This is the U.S. Capitol. And basically, they faced almost zero resistance to get to the Capitol grounds. There was a fence around the Capitol grounds, but it was the kind of fencing that you put up temporarily to keep like deer and stuff out of your garden. It was not a fence. It was not the kind of fence that's around Lafayette Park and around the White House. And I think they were just caught flat-footed by the focus of the protesters. This is something me and my colleagues were sort of hashing out in the aftermath, in that this wasn't a protest that sort of like went weird. You know, a lot of us have covered protests where somebody breaks a window and then everything goes mob violence and then sort of the madness of crowds. This was not necessarily organized, but it was very focused. They knew exactly what they wanted to do, and they kind of like probed the different ways to get into the building and to the steps and to pass the police. And it was hugely successful from their perspective.
Let's keep in mind that it started while the United States Congress was performing a vital ceremonial duty. Every 4 years after a presidential election, Congress, you could say, counts the votes. Now, they don't really do the count. The envelopes or certificates are opened from all 50 states and Washington, D.C. The vice president acts as the president of the Senate. And as the senators and House members are sitting together, state by state, the results are read aloud, and normally they're just accepted without any problem. This time it was clear that supporters of President Trump in both the House and the Senate would object, and that process had begun. It's alphabetical. So Alaska was no problem, Alabama no problem. But when they got to Arizona, well, then the House and Senate went into separate sessions to debate, and that's when the violence started. And that's when members of the House of Representatives had to actually get down on the floor and police, plainclothes police, right, holding their guns, pointing at the doors of the House of Representatives chamber to keep the rioters out of the chamber, whereas the protesters or rioters did get into the Senate chamber just after the vice president and 100 senators, all 100, were evacuated. It was a chaotic scene, but I didn't want to lose sight of the business. The business did get done. The Senate and House resumed their work late Wednesday night. They worked until about 4 o'clock in the morning on Thursday. And it is official now that Joe Biden, former vice president, former senator, will be the president, sworn in on January 20th. Kamala Harris, who's been a senator from California, will be the vice president. Josh, you know, in a way, at least America did fulfill its function, or Congress, you know, Congress did step up and do it.
They did. And it's really important that after the awful scenes we saw on Wednesday afternoon and evening, that Congress came back and did their duty and certified the results. And that's what's always been strange about this process that we've had of Trump denying and seeking to overturn the election results, is that it's never ever felt likely that it would happen. There's never been a massive support both in Congress or even beyond it for Trump's attempts. I mean, anyone who really looks carefully at what happened knows that there wasn't mass electoral fraud. But nonetheless, this performance has continued with these protests, with Trump's tweets, with these frivolous lawsuits being launched and then chucked out of court. And it carried on, this process, and it was almost felt as though there wouldn't be any serious repercussions, as though they could have run this election denialism. And there were people in Congress who said, well, they're not going to overturn the election, so why don't I give it a nod and a wink? You know, we're just raising questions, that sort of thing. Well, what we saw this week is that actions have consequences, and those consequences came to the very heart of American power, to the very heart of Washington, D.C., and we'll be living with them for a very long time.
Yeah, we'll have to see what the consequences are, or whether everyone in U.S. politics just wants to turn the page on January 20th. So for the record, the Senate and the House did debate some objections about some of the states, but a typical vote was on the Arizona objection. The United States Senate voted 92-7 to reject the objection. In other words, to accept the Electoral College numbers. And so it was overwhelming. But if one thinks about it, in the House of Representatives, with more than 100 of the 435 members wanting to reject the official count, That meant that more than half of the Republicans in the House were taking Trump's side. Now, this put Vice President Mike Pence in a situation of great pressure. President Trump publicly said that his Vice President Mike Pence, as ceremonial president of the Senate, should reject the numbers, send it back to the states, make them come up with new results so Trump could continue as president. Ashraf, the pressure was amazing, but Pence decided to just follow the script and act dignified.
Yeah, Pence was subject to intense speculation for the last week, really, and a lot on Wednesday. I spoke to one protester just before, just as they were getting started with the roll call of the states that only got to Arizona, as you said. And he was a minister, the head of a Christian NGO in Philadelphia. And he was putting a lot of stock in Pence. I was like, what do you think Pence is going to do? He's like, I don't know. He must be under a lot of pressure. And I said, it's okay. As a fellow man of faith, if Pence looks at the law and looks at his conscience and comes to the honest conclusion that I cannot interfere in this way, will that satisfy you? And he thought about it for a while. He's like, I think I could probably be at peace with that. And that's kind of the question, is who among the supporters now, who is Pence going to become a villain? The way that Bill Barr, the former attorney general, like immediately became a villain with this crowd? Or is the fact that he, as the man who kind of lent sort of moral armor in a way to many of President Trump's excesses in the minds of the Christian right, is he choosing not to fight this fight going to sway some of them with his credibility? Because we've seen when Bill Barr came out and said he couldn't find electoral fraud, the attorney general, immediately I was talking to protesters that were like, oh, he's a sellout. Oh, I had a woman tell me, oh, everyone knows he's good friends with Joe Biden. So is everyone going to turn on Pence now, or is his personal credibility going to sort of add a little bit of legitimacy or to take away some of the sting for these people?
As we're hearing, there are still strong divisions when it comes to politics in America. There were election results from Georgia that really will make a difference in Congress. We'll talk about that and a lot more after this short break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. And our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Just before our break, Ashraf was saying that Vice President Mike Pence had been under pressure. And what the pro-Trump protesters, some of whom, thousands of whom apparently broke into the Capitol building, what they thought about Pence as though the vice president would save their hero, President Trump, what they expected. In the end, it was Pence at 3:45 in the morning on Thursday who officially announced that Trump and Pence had lost and that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris had won the election. And Biden and Harris will be sworn in right there, just outside the Capitol building on January 20th. Josh Glancy, what's your take on the drama around Mike Pence?
Well, I think Mike Pence has shown himself to be someone who believes in the system and isn't willing to bend entirely under the will of his boss, Donald Trump. There have been times over the last few years when he's been somewhat quiet and reserved and withdrawn as a figure and has signaled his frustrations with the president very subtly. But when called upon this week to support the American system and the transfer of power and the Constitution and his duty as vice president, he did so. Behind the scenes, we know from reporting that Vice President Pence was absolutely furious with Donald Trump's failure to respond to the violence we saw in the Capitol. And it's been reported that it was ultimately the vice president and not Donald Trump who called in the National Guard and called in reinforcements to end the scenes in Congress. So you don't necessarily have to like Mike Pence or admire Mike Pence, but he has done his constitutional duty as vice president this week. And that's very important, because had he not, then we'd be in an even messier situation.
As for President Trump, he was banned at least for 12 hours from Twitter. That company, Twitter, decided no longer to put out the messages from President Donald Trump. No videos from Trump. Facebook made the same decision, meaning that Trump was also banned from YouTube. Those corporations decided that some of what Trump has been saying has been dangerous, has been mistaken, has been false, has been inciting trouble in the United States. Of course, this will cause more trouble in the sense of political conservatives thinking that Twitter, Facebook, and other social networking companies should not have this power to censor and decide who gets to be there. Anyway, there was a Twitter statement from a White House official on Thursday morning. It says Donald J. Trump declares, quote, "Even though I totally disagree with the outcome of the election and the facts bear me out, nevertheless, there will be an orderly transition on January 20th. President Trump in this statement says it's just the beginning of, quote, our fight to make America great again. But he is confirming, apparently, he'll be leaving on January 20th. And there is a big change. It's not only a Democrat. Joe Biden will be the president. Democrats still control the House of Representatives, though they did lose seats in November. But the United States Senate was just on the razor's edge. Would the Republicans hold it? Well, they won't. We got the results from Georgia, special runoff elections. Two Republicans who held their Senate seats, Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, they lost. They're gone. And the winners are the Reverend Raphael Warnock and documentary filmmaker John Ossoff. In America's Deep South, a state, Georgia, thought of as highly conservative, by a small margin, gave both victories to liberal candidates, a black church preacher, Warnock, and a Jewish journalist, notably only 33 years old, John Ossoff. So Josh Glancy, again, Georgia has surprised America. Do you think that was a response in part to Trump and his big outdoor rally on the eve of the Georgia election?
Well, I think it would be too simplistic to draw a direct line and say that, you know, Trump lost the Republicans Georgia. There's a lot of factors at play there. The Republicans ran two not hugely impressive candidates, both who had somewhat scandalous associations with allegations of insider trading around the pandemic, Loeffler and Perdue. The Democrats have run a really impressive get out the vote operation in Georgia for many years now, or several years, I should say, spearheaded by Stacey Abrams, a local activist and politician. So there are a lot of factors at play in Georgia. But nonetheless, you would have to look at the way Trump has gone to war with the Georgia Republican Party, including Governor Brian Kemp, the way allies of his have undermined the process and the election in Georgia, the call that was leaked that Trump had with a Georgia election official asking him to overturn the election. None of that is likely to have helped, because the reason Republicans lost in Georgia in November was because they alienated a lot of moderate suburban voters who previously were probably quite solidly Republican, but don't like the direction the party's taken under Trump and delivered the state to Joe Biden in November and appear to have delivered now the state to the Democrats again. And now they've given them control of the Senate, which changes the landscape of American politics for the next 2 years. So there's a lot of frustration in Republican ranks at the way that Trump and his allies muddied the waters and upset the apple cart, shall we say, down in Georgia with their allegations against the election. And it certainly hasn't helped them and has had electoral consequences.
Well, there are many signs that the Republican Party has internal divisions, not only in Georgia, but nationwide. And if the United States Senate now will be 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, Ashraf Khalil, it falls to you to explain to our global VOA News audience, 50-50, how is that a majority for the Democrats?
Well, when it's a 50-50 tie, the deciding vote is cast by the sitting vice president. So 50-50 becomes a majority. And so that makes Kamala Harris the deciding, essentially, tiebreaker going forward in these things. So the way that the American government is structured, that affects the checks and balances between the executive branch and the legislative branch. It certainly affects, especially on contentious issues that are likely to go down on a hard partisan split. So that comes up with a bunch of different issues, not only healthcare reform, either bringing back some form of Obama care or the subject of whether Washington, D.C. should become a state. I can almost guarantee that's going to come up during the next 2-year window. So if Republicans had retained control of the Senate has a lot of powers that are unique just to the Senate. And a Republican-led Senate could have greatly delayed or even derailed many, many, many of the major initiatives that a new Biden administration would have wanted to put in. So this really does clear the runway for sweeping changes.
And very soon, the United States Senate will be called upon to confirm or reject dozens of important nominations by Joe Biden as he becomes president, who will be his attorney general, who will fill other cabinet positions. We heard that Merrick Garland, who had been Barack Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, but the Republican-led Senate refused to even consider Garland back in 2016, that now he will be Biden's nominee to be attorney general. And because of what happened in the Georgia election, well, that means that Biden will probably get his entire cabinet confirmed. We have to talk about COVID-19, worse than ever. You know, last year, on average, about 1,000 Americans died every day since the pandemic began in March of last year. Lately, it's been well over 3,000 deaths a day. Hospitals in major cities, notably Los Angeles, are absolutely paralyzed with every bed being used to treat people. And in LA, ambulance drivers were ordered to assess, does this person have a chance to survive, let's say after a heart attack? And if they seem to have little chance, don't bring them to the hospital. Josh, this is just a shock for the American healthcare system, which has proven itself to be fragmented. Even the vaccines aren't being delivered in a quick and efficient way into the arms of America.
Yes, unfortunately, we're seeing the continuation of what has been a really systemic failure. And it's not just America that's faced this. A lot of Western countries, including my own country, Britain, have struggled deeply with the overall response to COVID-19, whether it's healthcare or government oversight or the vaccine rollout. As you point out, the vaccine rollout in America, after much celebration about the efficacy of the vaccines that have been developed by Pfizer and Moderna and others, they don't seem to be being rolled out very efficiently. There's a lot of reports of vaccines being left on the shelf and unused. Plans to get 20 million people vaccinated by the end of the year of 2020. America didn't come close to hitting that target. They're at about 4 or 5 million. And so the timeline, as it has been throughout, keeps getting pushed back. Well, we hope that we might have some normality by spring. Well, that doesn't look likely now, with just a tiny percentage of the American population currently vaccinated. In many ways, people look to 2021 as being better than last year. We sort of wrote off 2020 as a bit of a disaster. I think we now have to acknowledge that this is going to probably take up most of this year, and it's going to be a long, grim haul, and we're going to be counting death numbers and triaging at hospitals for many months to come.
Ashraf, what's your take on the American system, where the 50 states in Washington, D.C. have their own plans, their own schedules for when people can get the vaccine, instead of having a national system for delivering the vaccination?
Well, this is one of the quirks of the American response to the virus. America, as a country that was founded by revolutionaries trying to escape an overarching monarchy with absolute power, authority is devolved down to the states. The states, the individual states, have a lot of autonomy and are very reluctant to give up any of that autonomy. So as a result, especially with the COVID reaction and the absence of an overarching strategy from the White House, and that hasn't really been present, you've had states competing for ventilators last year. You've had different states have formed up as like almost like different pods to work together in the absence of federal direction. You actually had a kind of a nice story here in Washington, D.C., where Washington, D.C. was kind of being shortchanged on the number of vaccines it was receiving. And they were complaining about it, saying that the first shipment won't even cover 1/10 of first responders. And so the neighboring states of Maryland and Virginia each donated 8,000 doses to Washington, D.C. And so states can make of that what they want. In some cases, there's going to be competition and lack of coordination. And in some cases, you'll actually see states acting like little family units. So it all comes down to human nature in the absence of proper guidance from the top.
Despite all these challenges, Happy New Year to you, to our listeners. That's all the time we have. Our thanks, of course, to our panelists, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times, and Ashraf Khalil, Washington, D.C. Metro reporter for the Associated Press. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitch.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Caroline Hobenstricker, an intern with VOA's Current Affairs Desk and a student of journalism and global and intercultural studies at Miami University of Ohio. She's working with us as assistant producer this month. Our guest, Francis Lee, professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University and co-author of the recently published book, The Limits of Party, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. Her research has appeared in the American Political Science Review, Perspectives on Politics, American Journal of Political Science, and many other outlets. She's the recipient of numerous awards in the area of legislative studies. On this edition of the program, Professor Lee will talk with us about her most surprising findings, including the idea that Congress is less dysfunctional than typically thought, and that the passage of bipartisan legislation is still commonplace. According to a recent New York Times opinion editorial, Francis Lee and co-author David Curry assert, quote, "Divided government sometimes overperforms expectations. Unified governments, on the other hand, usually end in disappointment for the party in power. The harsh truth about the U.S. political system is that very little legislation gets enacted without bipartisan support." Closed quote. This week, Democrats Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff won two close Senate races in the southern state of Georgia, flipping the Senate, the upper chamber of Congress, from Republican to Democratic control. We'll talk with Professor Lee, who has also worked on Capitol Hill as an American Political Science Association Congressional Fellow from 2002 to 2003, about this important development. Many political analysts assert that the incoming Biden administration will actually benefit from unified government, even as it seeks and will need bipartisan support for legislative proposals. We'll also elicit Professor Lee's reaction to the storming of U.S. Congress by pro-Trump supporters opposed to what is normally a pro forma ceremonial process of certification of Joe Biden's presidential victory. And Professor Francis Lee joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Caroline Hobenstricker.
Hello. Thanks for having me as well.
Well, Professor Lee, I'd love to get your reaction to the events we witnessed on January 6th. Some political observers say we're at a turning point. Hundreds of Trump supporters angry about the fact that the Congress was about to officially affirm Joe Biden's electoral victory, which was actually certified on December 14, 2020, by the states who run our elections, stormed the Capitol building. This left several people dead, wounded, and it really stunned lawmakers and citizens across the country. What is your reaction?
I mean, we haven't seen anything like that in our lifetimes. In fact, nothing like that has happened at the U.S. Capitol. But I see it as flowing from the president's refusal to acknowledge defeat in the elections. Basically, what Congress was doing on January 6th was confirming that loss. And Republicans in the Congress were, in that sense, being asked to concede on the president's behalf effectively. This is normally, as you mentioned, just a ceremonial process, you know, almost vestigial from a time when the ballots needed to be brought in on horse and buggy and opened and counted. Of course, we all knew the outcome of the elections, and, you know, there was no doubt as to, you know, what Congress was being asked to do. We knew what the electoral count was. But the meaning of that ceremony had shifted because the president had not conceded. And that's what caused that session to take on such outsized importance. The president also had invited to come to the Capitol his supporters to rally on this day. and had encouraged them to go to the Capitol after that rally at the Ellipse. So we can see how this came to be and how it occurred, what the political logic of it was, and why that session took on outsized meaning. You know, as it's played out, it has effectively become the acknowledgement that the transition of power will occur. And in my view, the most significant feature of what happened in the early morning hours of January 7th was that most Republicans in the Senate, a large majority of Republicans in the Senate, acknowledged the legitimacy of the transition of power. That did not happen in the House of Representatives, however. A majority of House Republicans did not assent to the election outcome. So it's not a, you know, the verdict that we have from Congress is not a uniform acknowledgement of the legitimacy of the election outcome.
We're going to get more into that and the implications of what happened in a moment, but let me turn to your book called The Limits of Power, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. And I think we have to underscore the word polarized. What was the impetus for this book, which was co-authored by you and James Curry? And how did you reach your conclusions?
Our book is aimed at asking a simple question. What does the rise of partisan conflict and the centralization of power in legislative party leaders, what does that mean for lawmaking? How has that shaped lawmaking outcomes in national government? We knew that the processes in Congress had changed dramatically, that roll call votes in Congress break down on party lines to a much greater extent than they used to. And the parties are much more unified, much more cohesive. They vote together in opposition to one another to a much greater extent than in the past. We know that party leaders are much more central to the process, that the committees are not where a lot of the most significant legislation gets worked out these days. So we knew that the process had changed, but our question was, how much difference does this make for legislative outcomes? We were interested in whether there has been an increase in the tendency of legislation to be passed with the support of only one party, or of legislation to be passed on party line votes. And we also wanted to know whether majority parties in the contemporary, more partisan era are better at accomplishing their legislative agendas. And what we found surprised us, that there has been no increase in the frequency with which Congress legislates on narrow party line votes. Legislation still passes with bipartisan support, in fact, to the same degree that it did in the 1970s and 1980s, a much less party polarized time. So what this means is that the tremendous rise of party conflict that we see in Congress is not on outcomes, that bipartisan negotiation is still necessary to legislate. Second key finding is the majority party in the contemporary Congress is not more effective at achieving its legislative goals and enacting its platform than it was in less polarized periods. This is true even under conditions of unified control, that parties, when they possess the unified control of government, as the Republicans did in President Trump's first 2 years, are not more successful than Congresses with unified control in earlier periods, that they still fail about half the time, including on their top priority agenda items, just as we saw with the, you know, the Republican Congress in President's first year in 2017. They were able to pass their major tax reform and tax cut legislation, but they failed on their first legislative priority, which was to repeal and replace Obamacare. That is a typical pattern. That sort of encapsulates what we see parties fail about half the time, even when they have unified control. And they rarely legislate on narrow party line votes. So we have the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We have Obamacare. You know, those two are, you know, signature pieces of legislation that pass without any cross-party support. But in our research, Jim and I only found 12 such examples of top agenda priorities passed by a majority party without cross-party support, dating back to the Reagan years. This rarely happens, and it does not happen with more frequency. It's not emblematic of how Congress works. More emblematic of how Congress works was the CARES Act, which was the first major legislation passed in response to the pandemic, broad bipartisan support. Significant legislation sweeping, the largest stimulus package in American history. And yet passed, you know, with tremendous support across the aisle, both parties, that's the norm. That's how legislation, by and large, passes even now. It's not well understood. Congress's partisanship and partisan conflict in Congress is something that gets a great deal of news coverage. And Congress's tendency to resolve that conflict with legislation commanding broad bipartisan support is not understood, but remains a feature of how our national government works.
That's really fascinating. Well, before we go to a break, let me turn to my colleague Caroline Haubenstricker for a question.
Professor Lee, regarding your recent New York Times op-ed where you state that Senate majorities are overrated, do you think that an exception to that sentiment is warranted given how much Republican opposition there has been to President-elect Biden's certification as the winner of the election? In his case, isn't it more advantageous that Democrats, thanks to the election of two Democratic senators from Georgia, now hold a slim majority, enabling the Biden administration to more successfully enact at least part of their legislative agenda?
No doubt the Biden administration welcomes the outcomes of the Senate races in Georgia that afford Democrats majority control, bare majority control of the Senate. And it will be very helpful to the Biden administration in executive branch and judicial appointments. But when it comes to legislation, there won't be much legislation that passes on narrow party line votes with Democrats only in the majority and in support. That rarely happens. President Biden may be able to work with the Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate to pass a budget reconciliation package on a simple party line vote. That can happen. We've seen that happen in a number of recent presidencies. But that tends to be about it in terms of the legislation that passes without cross-party support. So that was how the Republicans passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act under President Trump. But that is not emblematic of how they legislated more generally. And in fact, that's the one case of a significant legislation passing on narrow party lines. So Democratic activists, progressives who look to the outcome in Georgia and expect that Democrats will be able to achieve sweeping change on the basis of Democrats-only support are likely to be disappointed. There isn't a precedent for that, even in recent polarized Congresses with unified control, that first there's the Senate filibuster, which remains in place for all legislation aside for budgets. So this requires bipartisan support in order to clear the cloture threshold in the Senate and bring debate to a close.
Sorry, just quickly, define for our international audience filibuster very quickly.
Filibuster is when senators block measures from coming to a vote. And even when they might otherwise pass, you know, where there's a majority for the measure, that it's possible for a senator to block it from coming to a vote unless the supporters of the measure can garner 60 votes. This is sometimes is referred to as the 60-vote Senate, meaning a supermajority is necessary in order to force a vote. And so the ability to delay or to deny supporters the opportunity to bring their measures to a vote, to use the Senate's procedures permitting extended debate to deny that opportunity, that's a filibuster. It's critical for understanding the role of the Congress in our political system, that the filibuster has emerged as a mechanism that forces bipartisanship in the Senate. To the extent that parties in the House and the Senate are similar, the fact that a minority party in the Senate can use the filibuster to block measures from coming to a vote, that forces bipartisanship, you know, across the Congress, not just in the Senate alone.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Francis Lee, professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University and author of the new book, The Limits of Party, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. She joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. I'm Carol Castiel, along with assistant producer Caroline Haubenstricker. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Tony Zola from Bangkok, Thailand. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Francis Lee. And Professor Lee, I'd like you to address the fate of the Republican Party. You said earlier that Democrats and Republicans have been pretty cohesive voting along party lines of late on legislation. But I wonder if you would reconsider that thought in light of today's events, in light of the political landscape. The Republican Party seems somewhat riven from within. You know, we see some are supporting, indulging President Trump's fantasy, many analysts say, that he won, that he didn't lose the election. They tried to delay the certification of President-elect Biden as the winner of the election. Some are saying that President Trump is sabotaging the Republican Party on his way out of the office. You know, how do you see the Republican Party going forward and then its role in legislation going forward?
I don't think we can extrapolate from these remarkable events of this week to how Republicans will behave going forward. That Republicans were uniquely cross-pressured as they weighed what to do in the wake of the 2020 elections and President Trump's refusal to concede. On the one hand, President Trump is the leader of their party. He commands broad support among Republicans in the electorate, and Republicans in the electorate believed the president when he said that the election had been stolen. So those are their constituents who they represent. So they feel pressure to represent those constituents who believe they've been defrauded. On the other hand, the constitutional role of the Congress in counting electoral votes submitted by states is quite limited. That elections are handled at the state level. Election administration is handled at the state level. And so there was very little Congress can do that Republican members could do in response under the Constitution. So they have their constitutional role on the one hand, running up against their partisan role and the need to be responsive to their constituents and to the leadership of their own party. And so this was uniquely difficult representational dilemma for Republicans. I don't think that that persists after the Trump presidency is over. And instead, I think Republicans will find themselves in less cross-pressured circumstances as a minority party in both House and Senate in reaction to an administration, also not of their party. That's a less difficult set of circumstances. They can oppose, they can go back to being the party of limited government and of lower government spending, and they can oppose large deficits. In fact, I suspect they'll be less cross-pressured now than they were in the Trump years, where the need to respond to the economic devastation of the pandemic led them to support levels of government spending that they were uncomfortable with, that they will not feel the same pressure to do that as a minority party. They'll expect Democrats to carry a larger share of the burden of governance in a Democratic administration. So I think this is a unique moment that we've seen here in the power transition that doesn't generalize to the future for the Republican Party, that their circumstances change dramatically when Trump is no longer president.
All right. I think we have a follow-up from Caroline on that very topic. Caroline.
Yes. So, Professor Lee, analysts, including President Trump's former Homeland Security Advisor, Tom Bassard, are saying that the breach of the U.S. Capitol building and the previous breaches of state capitol buildings, like in the state of Michigan, is because President Trump has been trying to delegitimize President-elect Joe Biden's victory. To what extent will these events have an impact on bipartisanship in Congress? And are the Republicans more likely or less likely to cooperate with the Democratic majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate?
Well, we'll have to see how accepting of the legitimacy of President Biden Republicans, both in the electorate and the Congress, will be. My expectation is that there will be more similarity between the Republican behavior under President Obama and what we'll see under President Biden, that President Obama's legitimacy was not uniformly recognized by Republicans in Congress. And there were many Republicans who doubted that President Obama had been born in the United States, that, you know, that those beliefs were, you know, reasonably widely held among Republicans in Congress during the Obama years. So the idea that up until the Biden administration, the Out Party has always recognized the legitimacy of the president, that would be an exaggeration. But I also see what happened on January 6th and 7th in the Senate as quite significant in conferring legitimacy on a President Biden, that when you have nearly all Senate Republicans accepting the Electoral College votes, and you have quotations like such as those from Senator Lindsey Graham saying that President Biden and Vice President Harris were lawfully elected. So I think that the legitimacy of the Biden administration was shored up considerably by what happened in the Senate, you know, in counting the Electoral College votes. So my answer is that Biden will not be uniformly accepted as legitimate by Republicans, but I think there's a critical mass there that will acknowledge the legitimacy and will be willing to cooperate in the same or roughly the same manner in which they have cooperated with other recent Democratic presidents.
I'd like to follow up with another question. So in your book, The Limits of Party, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era, you conclude that there is more intra-party disagreement than people think. This seems very relevant with respect to the current Democratic and Republican parties. Can you expand on how the current intra-party rifts may affect the ability to pass legislation under the incoming Biden administration?
Yes, this is a fact about our contemporary parties that's not widely appreciated, that because the parties are in most cases able to maintain their ranks on controversial issues that come to a vote in Congress, there's a tendency to assume that that means that they march in lockstep. But in general, when a party that controls the Congress cannot reach agreement within its own ranks, it doesn't bring the matter to a vote. And so you don't see the internal divides within the party play out on the floor of Congress because they don't tend to move forward on matters on which there's internal disagreement. That's what made, incidentally, looking back, the Republican failure on repeal and replacing Obamacare most stunning, that they did that in open and, you know, failed on the floor in high-profile votes. Usually a party will not do that. If it hasn't reached internal agreement, it won't bring the measure to a vote. So what Democrats would be asked to do if they wanted to try to legislate without any cross-party support is to maintain perfect party unity. All Democratic senators would have to agree. And there are some quite moderate members of the Democratic caucus who represent states that lean towards the opposing party. So it will not be easy to accommodate all the divergent perspectives within the Democratic Party. In the Senate, that would require perfect party unity. In the House, it will require nearly perfect party unity. You know, the Democratic majority in the House is extraordinarily narrow in the upcoming Congress, like 222 votes. So what are the issues on which literally every Democrat agrees? It's not a long list. And it's certainly not a long list of issues on which that are highly controversial, on which the parties, you know, the Democratic Party can, you know, reach perfect agreement. You take climate change, for example. Even when Democrats had large majorities, as they had under President Obama in 2009 and 2010, they could not successfully legislate on climate change. They got a bill out of the House of Representatives, but only because they had some Republican support. There were so many Democratic defections on that issue. They never came close to getting all Democrats on the same page in the Senate. So most of the time when a party is able to unify itself entirely around an agenda item, it also has cross-party support. It's not that controversial. And so I think what you should expect to see in the 117th Congress, the upcoming Congress, President Biden's first 2 years in office, is that very little legislation will pass if it doesn't have broad support, which has been the norm. And so the question then is, what can leaders put forward that commands broad support, not just can unify Democrats? And so that needs to be, if you're seeking to understand, you know, where we're likely to go in policy terms in the coming years, that legislation with that character, that ability to command support that extends beyond the majority party, that needs to be what we look to. And in many cases, that happens as a result of events, crises. what enabled Congress to agree on the sweeping legislation in the CARES Act in March 2020, or for that matter, the legislation that ended the Trump presidency, both in funding the government for the coming year and another coronavirus aid package. It was the sense that something must be done and that both parties agree action is needed. They may disagree on the scope of action. There may need to be hard bargaining, but fundamentally, both parties agree that action needs to be taken. That's when Congress acts, by and large. And so to look to those areas of consensus where both parties recognize the need for congressional action, that's where you see Congress move. And it's very hard to move Congress in the absence of that kind of consensus. This is something President Biden understands well with his long experience working in Congress. You know, he has said that if you can't get a consensus up here, that all you get is abuse of power by the executive. He said that during the campaign, and he's right about that. That's how Congress works. Congress is a bicameral body. It's very hard to move it, and it usually takes broad consent, broad support in order to move it. And a president who understands that is better positioned to lead the country in a closely divided time and a time where, you know, no shortage of crises that need addressing.
That is so true, Professor Lee. And as you said, President-elect Biden knows better than many as a longtime senator, and he has always pushed for bipartisanship. And he has a relatively good relationship, we understand, with now minority leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate. He will be the minority leader now that the Democrats gained those two extra seats from Georgia. So that will probably help. But I would like to remind our listeners that Will Rogers, an actor who passed away in the early 20th century, said, "I am not a member of any organized political party. I am a Democrat." I think that little adage, you know, remains true to this day. It is a broad, you know, big tent party. We have the so-called Democratic Socialists, a few of them, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and of course, Senator Bernie Sanders, who isn't even a registered Democrat. But really, the majority are, I would say, moderate center-left, and we're seeing more of that tendency in the Democratic Party. So let me ask you as we close, Professor Lee, you know, in the 117th Congress, what are, in your view, the prospects for enacting legislation? Where do you think we can find convergence? Particularly, you know, we're dealing with a pandemic still. It seems as if there may be no shortage of issues on which consensus can be found. But what are your thoughts? Are you cautiously optimistic?
I think that the pandemic dominates this first year for President Biden. So there will be need for additional aid for the unemployed and for affected small businesses and for vaccine distribution and to reopen the schools. That, you know, the list of challenges associated with responding to the pandemic is just fearsome. And congressional action is needed there. Congress is power of the purse. So Congress must be consulted and must be brought in, you know, in order to act in these areas. So I expect to see action on those issues. And I think that there is sufficient support across the aisle for that to command the usual and necessary bipartisan support for Congress to act. I'm not sure beyond that where the prospects lie. But I wouldn't underrate the potential for agreement to be reached, that a great deal happened over the past 4 years under President Trump, even though I don't think anybody would regard President Trump as, you know, as a highly, you know, effective legislative negotiator. And yet a great deal of significant legislation passed in recent years. And I don't think anybody would have said at the start of 2017 that there's a long list of issues on which Republicans and Democrats agree. And yet a great deal occurred. So I think, you know, we shouldn't assume that just because it's difficult for us to say, you know, where their agendas overlap, that they cannot, in response to felt need on the part of the country and their constituents, come together on important matters.
Frances Lee is professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University, and she's co-author of the acclaimed book, The Limits of Party, Congress and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. Professor Lee, thanks so much for sharing your insights about your book and obviously your reactions to the unprecedented events in recent days. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was Caroline Hobenstricker. She's assistant producer at the Current Affairs Desk. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Berman.